Hello, my name is Kate Lawler, and I am the director of the Violence Prevention Program at Swedish Hospital. I would like to thank the Domestic Violence Committee of St. Benedict Parish and Queen of Angels and St. Matthias Parish for hosting this podcast about domestic violence during the COVID-19 pandemic. The first question that I would like to address is, what adjustments has Swedish had to make to continue offering services to those experiencing domestic violence during the pandemic? At the beginning of the pandemic and during the surge of COVID cases and deaths in the spring of 2020, most of the advocacy services, both of our violence prevention program and our community partners in domestic violence, human trafficking, and sexual assault agencies, became remote. So we were talking with people over the phone rather than in person. So one example of this would be, let's say, a patient who's in a situation of domestic violence who comes into the emergency room. During that period in the spring, that person would be talking over the phone with a domestic violence advocate who was working from home. So that advocate would be doing safety planning and coordinating referrals to shelters, legal services, counseling, or other services that the person needs. By early June, as case counts started to go down and PPE is more widely available, the crisis intervention and advocacy services have moved back on site for in-person response in the hospital. Another example is, once the patient leaves the hospital, domestic violence services like counseling or legal services are still mostly being done by phone, and there is a lot of safety planning that goes into that because the survivor is often talking from home or from a place where there may not be a lot of privacy. So counselors and advocates have developed code words with the survivors that signal, for example, if it is not safe to talk right now, or if the survivor needs someone to call the police or get help in another way. So in general, I would say that as a field of domestic violence that has safety as one of its main objectives, COVID has given us new dimensions of safety to watch out for. So making sure that patients and staff are not exposed to COVID as we are interacting with each other, and taking into account the new precautions we need to take when talking with survivors over the phone, because there is a greater likelihood that the person who is doing harm may be close by. The next question that I would like to address is, what kinds of changes in domestic violence have you seen during the COVID-19 pandemic? So during the early months of the pandemic, we saw fewer cases, and I think that was because people were afraid to come into the hospital. In May and June, we really started to see the domestic violence cases increase, not only in number, but also in severity. Similar to other health issues, I think people maybe were waiting longer before they came in. So we see very acute cases of domestic violence, for example, that involve head injury and strangulation, which are indicators of very escalated violence. We are also seeing a significant number of cases that involve alcohol, which I see as an indicator of the stress that people are under right now and the use of alcohol as a coping mechanism. Other changes that we have seen in domestic violence during this time relate to how services have changed in the community. So I've already talked about how many of the advocacy and counseling services are now being done remotely. Domestic violence shelters have also had to put into place social distancing practices, which means that they cannot house as many people in one location. So it's important to know, though, that shelter is still available, and people who need shelter should call the Illinois Domestic Violence Hotline, and that number is 1-877-863-6338. I think we often think about, when we think about domestic violence, we think about shelter. And we think about people in situations of domestic violence who are trying to leave those situations. And that is, of course, much of what we are working with and concerned about. There are also issues that people continue to face even after they have left the situation of harm. And so those situations often intersect with issues of immigration status, divorce, custody, and visitation. So those elements or components of domestic violence situations have become more complicated by court closings or delays due to physical distancing. And so people who need a decision to be made around one of those factors, for example, when someone's immigration process is linked to a person who is harming them, who is a U.S. citizen, there are federal programs that enable us to delink their immigration case for to delink the case from that U.S. citizen's case under the Violence Against Women Act. So, but those kind of procedures and processes are more difficult right now because there have been a lot of delays in immigration processing. And similarly with the divorce and custody and visitation decisions and, you know, court hearings that need to take place, people in many cases are just feeling like they're in a holding pattern before those decisions can continue to move forward. Orders of protection can still be obtained. Throughout this process, we have been able to help people get orders of protection. Sometimes that is done remotely, and the domestic violence hotline is a good place to get information about how you can apply for an order of protection. So we wouldn't want anyone to think that that is no longer available, because that kind of misinformation can cut people off from services that continue to be available. They might just be available in a different way right now. The next question that I would like to address is, what steps can the community take to extend support to families who might be experiencing domestic violence? So, you know, we all know that a lot of families are currently separated from many of the in-person communities that might pick up on red flags or offer support for someone who's in a situation of domestic violence. So places like schools, places of worship and work. And therefore, it is more important that people are prepared to pick up on red flags and offer support in their closer circles. So, for example, with family, friends, neighbors. This is also a time when it's important to get information to people in discreet ways and in the places that they are still going to. So, for example, like grocery stores, pharmacies, food banks, information about domestic hotlines and services can be posted in those places, along with information about other social support. So if your church has anything in particular that they're wanting to offer to survivors of domestic violence, those kind of real local places that people are still going to would be good places to see if you can get that information posted. I know that faith communities are also really important hosts of the physical spaces for groups like Alcoholics Anonymous or Al-Anon to meet. So I think that that support, you know, we need to make sure that that support continues to be available in whatever way it is safe for it to be extended. And, you know, because that support is more important now than ever, and we don't want people struggling with addiction to be feeling isolated at a time when they really need support. The last question that I want to address is, what support can family, friends, neighbors, and others offer when domestic violence is suspected? So what I would say here is that there are two important principles to any support that family, friends, or neighbors offer. So the first is that you don't want to do anything that makes the person who is doing harm feel that they are losing power and control. So some examples of this would be confronting that person. So it might make you feel better to confront the person, let's say your neighbor, and say, you know, I hear how you're talking to your partner, and I hear those threats that you're making, and I want you to know that that's not acceptable. And I'm going to call the police the next time I hear you talk like that to your partner. Or, you know, letting that person who's doing the harm know that you're aware of the situation. You know, this can put the survivor in greater danger because anything that threatens the abuser's sense of power can lead to them kind of tightening the controls. So they may not let the survivor talk with you anymore. If that person is your friend or a family member or even a neighbor, they might just really isolate that person even more, because they see that they're starting to lose control by, the survivor having communication with others. The second principle is to trust the survivor's own decisions about their safety and do not judge them for the decisions that they make. You know, that person is in survival mode, and that person is the only one who knows all the factors that go into their safety calculation. And while from the outside, you might be thinking, I don't understand why you're staying and you're making a bad choice by staying, it may actually be the safest option that they have right now, because an even greater threat is being made as to what will happen to them or to their kids or to other family members or people that they love if they try to leave. So it's really important to know that the most dangerous moment for a domestic violence survivor is that moment when they are trying to leave. And if they do not have a plan in place that has thought through all of the factors that might make that plan go awry, like if they forgot to get some critical medication that they have at home, that they can't go 3 days without that medication, they're going to have to go back, and the survivor will then maybe find the person that's harming them really angry because they went away for one night and now they have come back for the medication and they're going to be in greater danger. Or if they didn't think about all of the documents that they were going to need to be able to register their kids in a new school or to apply for a job. So those are safety planning measures that domestic violence organizations are expert in helping people think through all of those factors of a plan. And domestic violence organizations work with people, whether they continue to be in the situation where they are experiencing harm or whether they're no longer in that situation, that support is available to them. You know, it makes me really sad when I hear survivors say that they no longer have the support of their family or friends because those people lost patience with them for not leaving, because this plays right into the hands of the person who is doing the harm, because they may want the survivor to be isolated, because that way they have more power. So when we send messages to the survivor that are kind of like ultimatums, like if you don't leave, we can no longer interact with you because you're making a bad choice, that just really isolates them and makes them feel judged. And so the more that we can offer a support that trusts survivors and also understands that this is a process, and people need a lot of support to make decisions that are best for them, and they need people who are walking beside them and supporting them and believing in them in order to make those best choices.